Well, hey, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of The Boundless Show. This is Lisa Anderson. Great to be with you. Later on, we have Joshua Rogers here to answer a question from a guy who's struggling with applying confidence in his life. And if ladies like confidence so much, how can he make it work for him? And then for our culture segment, I was actually out traveling. And so Catherine sat down with Mylan and Kay Yurkovich regarding the topic of love styles based on their book, where they've done a lot of research on this and how it plays into relationships. Well, here we are for our roundtable. And this week we have a group of guys at the table, and I'm actually not present. Tim Nestor is hosting this one, and he and the guys are going to have a discussion around career, work, the whole idea of men and how they relate to their work and how it plays into other areas of their life. So take a listen.
Hey guys, I'm Tim Nestor, and I am here with Glenn, MT, and Logan. Thank you guys for joining for the conversation.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yep.
And we are here to talk about guys and work. Now, this isn't, I think we've already talked about, we've heard about women and work. This is all about guys and work. And I think we approach work a little bit differently. It's just the way God made us. We just think about work a little differently. So when I think about work, I always go back to my very first job. And I remember it was the summer after my seventh grade year of middle school, and I remember working with a bunch of ladies my mom's age in a mail center at a local university. And I thought that this is what work is. You come in, you listen to the recent gossip, we complain about our husbands together. That's what I thought it was. You know, that's kind of, that was my first experience with work. And so, and after a series of jobs like that, it took me a little while to finally get to a job that I thought, I'm serious about this. This is really important to me. So I'm just curious, just to get things started, what was the first job you remember thinking, this is really important to me? Outside of the fact that I need the money, this is really, really important to me. Is there a job that jumps to mind for you when it comes to importance?
I just got out of my first real job. I mean, I graduated, I'm only 25, so graduated college and then came straight to Axis, where I've been working for almost 3 years. And I think I was fortunate enough that, like, even though it kind of landed in my lap. I didn't necessarily go searching for it, but I ended up staying for a long time because I actually found, wow, this is, it's really important what we're doing. And I love what we do. And yep. So that's actually been my only experience. Yeah. So I don't know about you guys, but that's kind of been my experience so far. And like, I mean, I know that's kind of rare for a lot of people that you don't get, you know, your first job out of college is like, wow, this is something that I actually deeply care about and something that I would like to even do potentially even long term or something in this field.
That's great.
But that was kind of my experience.
Now there's a segue for me. So, so the first degree that I had was in business. Actually, as an actuary, as a bean counter, if you will. Yeah.
That's
so
great.
So statistician, really. And I worked in a career that was a very good career, made good money, was on a great career track. But I could do the job, but my heart wasn't in it because I didn't feel like I could see the end result of what I did impacting somebody else's life.
Right.
And so I went back to night school, did some classes in more a counseling field, and then realized, hey, this is really scratching an itch for me, and it's bringing together my work that I can do as, you know, my career with what I really love.
Right.
And so it wasn't until I went back to graduate school, got a graduate degree, got into that field that I really felt like, hey, this is something I could really do sustainably for the rest of my life.
I think for me, it was after I got my master's degree in counseling and had a couple of different internships. One was working in the inner city. One was working at a church and working for a Christian psychologist. And those, I think, were kind of the first time I felt like, okay, this is a direction that I'd like to continue to move in. I felt pretty scared, in a sense, and just starting out, but I felt that that was a direction that would be meaningful.
Yeah, no, I'm very similar. The first job that I had that wasn't, you know, a part-time janitor at a church or pizza delivery, I was actually working in youth ministry, and that's when I finally cared. You know, yeah. I had these people that were twice my age calling me Pastor Tim, and it was weird. It was a new world, and I felt it was a combination of things. I think I felt important. I knew the work I was doing was important. When I would have a teenage kid come over to my house and he would just be in tears over this horrible decision he made. And I just realized this is having an impact, you know, so that's when it was important. But thinking about the importance of work, sometimes it can become our identity and it can become too important. Yeah. And I know I've been told this a lot over the years from different mentors and folks I've talked to about this. And that is, what you do doesn't necessarily define who you are. It can be a very important part of who you are. Why do you guys think that, and I think it is a thing for men especially, why do you think we identify ourselves so closely with what we do? Why is that? Why do men do that so often?
I will say so my experience working at Axis, so for those of you who don't know, like, we work with a lot of churches and schools and trying to help parents and caring adults talk with their teenagers. And so we look at pop culture and whatnot. And so we've analyzed a lot of, like, right, what messages does culture give us today? And I think one of the biggest messages, and there's a lot more to it than this, but I do think one of the biggest messages that, like, all right, guys, like, your success is determined by what job you have. Like, that is success for us. And so we put a lot of pressure on ourselves because we're like, well, if I don't make this much money, if I don't have this title, then I'm not going to be successful.
Right.
And so it can become easy to say, like, all right, I have to be this or else I'm a failure as a person. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's easy to make that link when, you know, if we're working a job that we don't want to do or it doesn't make a lot of money, or it's easy for us to say, wow, I am a failure.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of that comes from culture and maybe even your own family, depending on your upbringing. Mm-hmm. But I think culture is a big piece of it and the message that they tell us.
I think I inadvertently feed into that too. So when I'm introducing myself, my name is Tim, I'm married, I've got this many kids, and what's the next thing I always say? This is, here's what I do, right? It always comes, and sometimes that's a question you ask if you're trying to fill the silence, make small talk. So what do you do? And so it's part of how we define a lot about ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And I think if we were to kind of simplify it down to two words, action or relationship. Hmm. Action is really more, men will focus in, I mean, you have action figures.
Right,
you know,
that's true.
And whereas relationship.
I mean, I don't, you might.
Yeah. and it doesn't mean that for men, relationships aren't important. They are. And it doesn't mean for women that action's not important. But I would say, generally speaking, there's probably a greater emphasis. And so work becomes either a pursuit of worth or a pursuit of wealth. Mm-hmm. And that becomes, if we're finding
That's
some
good.
Success in it, it's really easy, especially if the relationship side of things isn't working real well, to just kind of put ourselves completely in that and, you know, kind of go for the gold.
Yeah. No, I like that worth versus wealth thing. I like that. That's a good way of looking at it. So there are a lot of guys who write into Boundless who are asking, am I financially stable enough to get married? So you think about, not only is your identity, but also, am I ready for this? Like, is my job providing for my family, my future wife, future kids in a way that I'm ready for this? And so I feel like job is also closely tied to our stage of life. What stage am I in now? What stage am I going to next? And am I ready for this? So what advice would you give to those folks? What experience have you had in that yourselves personally? And why is it, I guess, why do we feel the necessity to be totally ready before making that next life stage leap?
I think that's just fear. And I think this is the first of many iterations. You know, am I ready to have our first baby? Am I ready to retire? Am I ready to, I mean, you could ad nauseum this. So this is not, this. There's a common theme here.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, I'm afraid. I don't know. There's this sense of the unknown. Hmm. And in one sense, I think it's a complex question that has a lot of answers. I mean, in one sense, you'll never be ready,
right?
If that's really the standard. But in another sense, can you be ready enough?
Yeah.
And I think that's a better question to ask. Mm. You know, have I made some wise choices? Have I thought it through? Do I have some kind of a budget, you know, that maybe I don't stick to perfectly, but at least it exists, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, have I thought it through? And then making an intelligent decision to move into it, because the truth is, it's always going to turn out different than you expect.
Right.
So you've got to dance in the moment.
Yeah.
And you've got to be flexible and resilient.
Well, so what actually is enough then? Because so I'm kind of in this right now. I've been dating my
girlfriend. Guys, let's solve this.
Yeah, here we go.
We'll give
the answers
right now.
Let's do it.
I've been dating my girlfriend almost a year, and we're moving towards marriage. Mm-hmm. And so I actually just left Axis last Friday, so very recently. And I am looking at what I want to do with my career and whatnot. And I'm also, you know, looking at my relationship with her.
Right.
And I know that there's eyes on me, whether she intends for there to be or not. Like, I know, like, she's looking to see if I'm going to be able to provide for her should we enter into marriage. And so it's like, okay, how much should I, what should I have accomplished by now? What should, what does actually mean to be ready? Because I'm like,
great question.
I want, I'm like saying yes and no to certain jobs or something like that based on maybe income, because I'm like, well, I need this much because that's what's going to be success in my marriage. So I don't know what your guys' thoughts are on that. But
well, I think there's not a particular or specific bank account amount.
Yeah.
I think what's key is where's the balance in my life?
Mm-hmm.
And the balance on one side is to view income or work simply as I need money to live, or is it a situation where I feel like this is my calling, this is a direction I want to go. And it doesn't mean that we don't have opportunity to shift gears. MT mentioned, you know, shifting gears, and that's going to happen. But is it more than just a job? Is there a direction? Is there a career I'm in? And really, I think there's value in taking kind of almost a time inventory, looking at your relationships, you know, how I deal with finances. Am I living in momentary gratification? So anything I see, I have to buy. That's not a great indication that I'm ready for a relationship. Am I able to wait? How do I deal with relationships in general? What are my friendships like? I mean, I think there are a lot of different areas that kind of speak into that.
Yeah.
Am I ready financially piece?
Yeah. Is there good balance in my life
Absolutely.
Now?
Yeah.
You know, I've been married 15 years coming up this fall. And I think back to when we first got married, I still had 1 year of school left, just for undergrad degree, still had 1 year of school left. My wife had finished nursing school and she was working, you know, those 3 12-hour shifts a week. I was delivering pizza during the evenings and on weekends, and I was working as a part-time janitor at a church during the day when I wasn't in class. And so I remember thinking, I think our total income that year was in the teens, maybe. Like, it was low, but we were able to find the housing that we needed, the student housing, and we were able to pay the bills that we needed. I leaned on my parents a little bit to get laundry done and stuff like that. I think back to those years as some of the best years. It's not because we didn't have kids yet, kind of. but I think back to that, and I thought if we waited until we were totally ready, I actually wouldn't have had the same connection with her that led to my first job, believe it or not, because I ended up getting my first job through a mutual connection there. And so, and that's when I started, went to work for a church, and now my career is totally different. I'm not in ministry anymore. You know, now I work in digital marketing, building websites and looking at analytics and stuff like that. So I don't know that I was ready either. I don't know that I would look back and say that was a financially super wise decision to get married right then.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I think God had prepared us. Our relationship was in a place where it was a good time to get married. We were able to create some great friendships during that time of other young newlyweds and things like that. So I don't think there's necessarily a perfect time, but I do think that it's, in my opinion, it's more about your balance of life as well as your relationship itself. If you were to have to struggle financially a bit, what would that do to your relationship? Mm-hmm. Have you talked about that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so those are more important to me, I think, than the bank account number.
Yeah. And I will say, like, even as I've talked with her a lot about this whole thing, and as I've been looking for a job and all that, I think one of the biggest things that has come up that she has kind of reaffirmed is like, look, it's not about the job that you get specifically. It's more like, I just want to know that, like, this is something you're thinking about. Like, are you thinking about how you would provide for a family? Are you thinking about, like, our relationship and how this would affect that? It's not necessarily you need to have this job or you need to do this. It's just, there needs to be thought behind it, which I don't know, I think makes sense. It should be something that men think about, and the ramifications of, all right, if I take this job, this is going to happen. And so that was helpful for me, at least in my conversations
and
with her.
She was asking you this? She sounds really smart.
Yeah. We've had a number of conversations about it. So yeah, she's very smart.
and back to what Glenn was saying, I do think that a big piece of this is that balance element, you know, balancing family, balancing work. So let's say you do land that amazing job and your career path is looking fantastic and things are going well there. Then how do you bring that balance back a little bit away from, maybe not away from career again, but balance back out family, mm-hmm. quality time with your wife, making sure you never stop dating each other, especially as the kids arrive. And how do you find that balance with family? And so I'd love for MT and Glenn to speak into that. Some of your advice and things you've experienced yourselves or in your chats with others. What advice would you give as you're getting ready to get married and stepping into the real deep career world and balancing
that? This is what you're asking, but it may not be what you're asking. I think you have to have a commitment to do whatever it takes.
Hmm.
Whether it's financially or when your kid has a diagnosis you don't know what to do with or, you know, somebody, a family member dies and now she wants to move closer to where that, like it could be anything. And so there has to be a commitment. It's not just about you anymore. Mm. You know, it's about this family that you're a part of.
That's good.
Surprises.
And and the surprises that will come,
come.
Yep. And so there has to be a commitment on the front end to do whatever it takes. That would be you know, the main thing, and to realize that it's not just your values anymore.
Yep.
When you're married, it's your Sam from the South, I could say this, y'all's values, right? so it's her values has to be taken into account just as much as yours does.
Sure.
And it's the shared values and how we're going to move forward.
And so how do I know if I'm ready to tackle whatever it takes? So if I'm in that position, if I'm in Logan's position and I'm, you know, on the cusp of some major decisions, what direction do I want to go in with my relationship, with my career? And I want to do that. I want to get to that place where I feel as a man, as a husband, as a father someday, as a coworker, that I'll do whatever it takes to strike the right balance. How do I know that I'm there?
One question and that comes to mind is, do I have any unresolved hurts that I've just pushed aside or pushed down, tried to ignore, try to maybe at times even spiritualize? Are there some hurts that I really need to just lean into and work through those? I often think of Jesus' words, probably my favorite verse in Scripture, Matthew 5:4, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Mm-hmm. And when we have those pockets of pain, our natural tendency is, I don't want to touch that with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah.
So we push it down. The problem is it will come up. And it will come up when you marry. It will come up when you have a child. It will come up in a difficult work situation. We never get to the place where it may never hurt. But we can get to the place where we've been able to process through it and we've been able to look at it from a perspective of God. What's the truth about this? Who am I? Whose am I? I mean, when you think of work, we can go either direction. We can go in the, let me just do it, I need to get by. Or we can go into my worth is dependent upon my salary. And both of those are not where it's at.
Right.
And so finding that level of contentment and peace ultimately in the Lord. But there are some areas sometimes where we have to kind of lean into the pain because it's not fun and our natural inclination is away from it. But if we don't do it, it'll catch up with us.
Hmm. And I would say from on the front end, to do premarital counseling or maybe even pre-engagement counseling to talk about the big rocks. If there's something that really matters to you with regard to career, where you want to live in the country or how many kids you want, whatever.
Yeah, pets.
Yeah. Those conversations need to be, if it really is held that tightly, it needs to be talked about ahead of time.
That's
because
good
that
advice,
may not be the right person for you. See, on the front end of the marriage, you have the right to say, I don't think this is the right fit. Once you say I do, God says you got to do whatever it takes.
Right.
This is something you've put your hand to the plow, and it needs to be honoring to the Lord. And now it's about giving your life for her as Christ did. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's a different view on the front end versus the back end.
So what you're saying there's a lot of wisdom in it, and it still, I think, might instill fear in those who are on the precipice of those decisions. What would you say to someone who's like, yeah, that sounds great, but it also sounds terrifying? So how do I deal with that fear?
Fear is a good thing because it makes you have to stop and in a focused way say, is this the right choice for me?
Yeah.
And so leverage the fear. The fear is telling you it matters.
That's good. That's good. So let's go back to talking about a little bit of the type of job or career that you might get. So when you think about finding this right balance on the other side of the relationship, when am I ready to get married? When do I say, I'm going to settle for this? I say settle a little bit casually, but settle for this job. Maybe it even pays well. Like MT, you were describing earlier, a job that paid well, but you weren't really getting that satisfaction out of it. What advice would you guys give? And Logan, this could be for you too, or what would be your thoughts on this with keeping that job that's paying the bills, but maybe every morning you wake up and you're kind of like, I wouldn't mind if work got canceled today. And if you start thinking that regularly or you're just kind of going through the motions, and compare that with everything from the financial differences between a dream job and a, you know, a utility job, as well as just your passion day to day. What advice would you give? What experience have you guys had with that?
My primary experience is a little bit limited in that, like, I've only had one career type job since college. But
what was your job before that?
I worked at like Starbucks. Worked at Jimmy John's. Food industry. I will never go back into food industry.
You're done with free smells.
I'm done. But I will say, growing up, so my dad was in the Air Force for 21 and a half years, and he was an engineer, and I mean, it did well for our family. Mm-hmm. I will say, in talking to him as I've gotten older, it was not his favorite. He did it because, and he even has told us this growing up. I have two brothers. He's told us growing up, like, you need to be able to, kind of what you were saying, you need to be able to do whatever it takes to provide for your family. Now, he took it to, you need to have like job security immediately. And so right out of college, he made the decision to go into the Air Force, and did it for 21 and a half years. And he, in talking with him now, you can tell that he's just like, I'm done with this. Like, I probably sacrificed some things that I maybe wanted to do in the name of job security and financial security for my family, which I don't think there's anything wrong with that. That was a decision that he made, but you can still look back at his life and he would probably tell you, like, I don't know. Maybe I could have done something a little bit different. Yeah. But at the same time, now my family really appreciated it because we never had to worry about, meals being put on the table. So,
and I would say it's important not to get into a spending lifestyle that at some point I can only do what I'm doing to keep up.
Yeah.
In other words, if you're spending too much and, my job is supporting that, but I really hate my job, it's not what I believe is ultimately my best fit, well, now you're kind of stuck.
Yeah, that's true.
And so if you're able to kind of go lighter on the front end, so to speak, you may be in a better place if you do need to make a shift into a different career.
And see, Logan, I would say the Air Force decision is one way to, quote unquote, do whatever it takes. But when I say do whatever it takes, that it doesn't necessarily mean that one value is trump. I mean, you could be a starving artist and have three other jobs, and that's doing whatever it takes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay? So the do whatever it takes is a shared value between husband and wife to say, hey, these are our values together. You can take something that's a secure job, or you can take something that's really, quote unquote, insecure. Mm-hmm. But whichever path you go, based on those shared values, are you willing to do whatever it takes to make ends meet and to take care of the needs?
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's really good. So when I also think about, you talked about career trajectory a little bit. Is there ever a place for you to say, you know what, there's not a great career trajectory here. I'm not sure what this is going to explode into, CEO level something, but you know what, I'm satisfied with this work. I think financially we'll always have to cut some corners and buy the smaller house and that kind of thing, and we won't be able to live like you're talking about, Glenn.
Right.
But you know what, I'm finding value in this position. Do you think there's a value in that as well? Would you give someone the advice to say, you know what, there's something valuable about contentment?
Well, there's something about the husband and wife talking through, those issues. You know, if one spouse, let's say, has the idea that I need to marry a person, they will be the only person working, and that can be fine and good.
Yeah.
But it may not be a shared value by both.
The premarital pre-engagement stuff MT was talking about, discuss those things on the front end.
Absolutely.
Like my wife and I, from the beginning, we got a certain amount of budget to plan our wedding. And I remember knowing right from the start that we were on the same page, because I always thought, I don't want an expensive wedding. That's a waste of money. Let's have a smaller, simple. And she was way ahead of me on that. She was cutting corners, saving money. And so we were given this budget for the wedding, and we ended up spending like $1,000 less of that, and we had $1,000 to spend on our honeymoon. So I was like, she is the one for me. But our whole lives have gone that way. You know, I love to share the story of how we adopted. This was almost 10 years ago now. And we adopted without being ready. Our bank account number, like you mentioned earlier, was not what it should have been to pull the trigger on that adoption. This cost us a lot of money. But we both knew in our hearts we were ready. We were ready to add this additional child to our home. We already had one biological kid. And we just felt God really... This is around the time of the you remember the earthquake in Haiti about I guess it was 11 years ago now. And so as we're watching the need that's out there, we started to talk about what can we do to help someone in need. And maybe it's in the U.S., maybe it's around the world. So we dove in head first. We weren't ready. I remember all of our parents kind of saying, what are you doing? So we weren't ready financially, but it was amazing to watch how God provided. Because I really felt like when both of us felt this is what we're supposed to do, God opened the doors. Whether it was a fundraiser here, a random gift from a distant relative in Australia, that was real. Those kind of random things happened as they heard what we were doing. And next thing you know, the debt we built up within 12 months after we brought him home was gone. Because God had just provided in ways that my job wasn't paying for. My wife's a stay-at-home mom. So I think there's more than just having the financial planning, career planning in place. A lot of it has to do with, has God set both your hearts on that same trajectory? Mm-hmm. And that's why I know people get a little scared at the counseling. Go to a counselor, go to a premarital counseling. That can make people feel a little bit overwhelmed, or maybe even, I've even seen some roll their eyes at the idea of it, like, no, we're fine. When we get in trouble, then we'll go to a counselor. I highly recommend, I love that suggestion. You can get so many great tools. It actually can be a lot of fun as well. You can laugh together, learn about each other, and perhaps avoid making a major mistake.
Yeah, do you want to fall in the hole or do you want to walk around it?
Exactly. All right, well, guys, we're out of time. Thank you so much for taking time to talk about work, being guys, access, apparently.
Yeah.
but I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, here we are for our culture segment, and as I mentioned at the front end of the show, I was not here for this, and so Catherine took on this interview. It is with Mylan and Kay Yurkovich. They are prominent psychologists and authors of the book How We Love, which really deals a lot with how your childhood and events in your childhood affect your love style today. Great things to know as you're single, preparing for marriage. So let's take a listen.
Mylan and Kay, welcome to The Boundless Show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Catherine.
I'm so excited to talk to you. I was telling you before we started talking that as soon as I got engaged, one of the first things someone said was, you have to read Mylan and Kay's book. And to be honest, I was a little scared of it because it involves, you know, going back and finding childhood wounds. But I think it's so good and so fascinating. And I think our listeners, even if they're not currently dating somebody, will find that this is helpful for, like, all of their relationships.
Absolutely.
So I'm so glad you're here. So I want to start with this concept of getting stuck. And you say it happens to every marriage. My question is, when? When did it happen for you all? When did you start realizing, okay, we have a problem here and it's not going away?
Well, I think by year three, we definitely had that core pattern that results when two attachment histories collide. And so I think for different couples, we've worked with couples who are dating and already can recognize that they have this pattern that repeats. So I think it's different lengths of time for different people, but it pops its head up pretty early.
When did you start seeing it?
I would say year three, wouldn't you?
I do. I think, you know, the idealism of marriage, dating, the excitement, eventually it starts to wear down a bit. And then we're faced with the realities of what we're feeling in this relationship and what we're thinking as a result of those feelings. And we have to ask ourselves, where do those feelings come from? You know, and a lot of times those feelings are historical. You know, if I feel insecure around K, I have to stop and ask myself, were there other times in my life or history that I felt insecure? Oh, this is something I've felt in all relationships. And that's what our book attempts to help people understand, is that what I will feel in a primary relationship, which is dating, engagement, and marriage, or parenting, or close friendships, I'm going to start to feel things that are familiar to me that I've probably felt in several different relational contexts in the past.
Hmm. And this is called attachment theory, right?
It is. It's 70 years. By the way, Catherine, this is 70 years of attachment research that is worldwide research that studies the connection between the infant and the caregiver and the bond that is recreated, or the lack thereof, or the interruptions thereof. And it shapes the view of self, other, the caretaker, and who is we. And all those early experiences shape our feelings going forward. So,
yeah, we have a little saying that your marriage or even your dating problems didn't begin when you met each other. They begin before you ever met. Because the reactivity we have in relationships is historical.
Right.
And but we often don't see the connection that someone is doing something or creating a painful experience for me that I've already experienced in my life before. And it's amazing, but we just don't see that it's historical as well as current.
So I want to hear about what you figured out when you got married. So Mylan, I think I associate with you a lot. I took the quiz and I'm also a pleaser. That's what you are, right?
No, so, I'm not anymore. I used to be.
Oh, yes. Recovering.
I'm not a pleaser anymore.
You're not a pleaser anymore.
That's why I could say no to you just then.
That's good. Good job.
See?
You notice I just nodded. I'm still working on it. So there are four unhealthy love styles, right? And then one that's a good style. So let's talk about one of the unhealthy ones, being a pleaser in marriage. So what does that look like? Give me an example of, you know, early marriage, you're like, this is not working.
Okay. Pleasers are fear-based. They need the other person to be positive or to reinforce, you know, something back to them. They need reassurance all the time because of their insecurities. And so my well-being and my self-esteem was based upon Kay's view of me or her reactions around me. If she was happy, if she was smiling, I would feel okay inside. I would be happy inside and I would smile. If she was unhappy, I would assume there was something wrong with me. You see, I didn't have the capacity to separate from others well, which meant whatever she was, I was. And that's not a healthy place to be. In other words, I'm too tied to the emotions and the state of being of the other person. I can't stand apart and let you just be you. I have learned subsequently to let her be not okay and me still be okay. And that's the goal, is no matter what is going on around me, that I can still be okay, that she doesn't have to, because I don't need that constant reinforcement over and over and over again. So I found myself early on in the marriage perpetually chasing her to try to find out what her emotional climate was, because if she was quiet, I would get unnerved, because in my home growing up, quietness was something that was leading to a storm or the aftermath of a storm. So to be quiet, to pull away, to distance, which introverts need to do. She's also an introvert, not to be confused with the avoider. But then there was not a lot of feedback. There was not a lot of inquiry, because she was formerly an avoider, and so she wouldn't engage much. And so that made me highly insecure. So it created a frustrating chase scene on my end.
So let's talk about the avoider for a minute. What does that mean, Kay?
The avoider comes from a home where there's just not a lot of personal talk, emotional emotions in my family. If I got sad, my dad got mad. If I got sad around my mom, she got very anxious, like, I don't know what to do with you. So there was really an undercurrent of a message that said, don't show me your feelings. And when you do that long enough, then you just stop knowing that you even have feelings, or you dismiss them long enough and they're hard to access, or access, I should say. So the avoider tends to be emotionally disconnected. I didn't have a lot of empathy because I didn't have memories of comfort growing up. Nobody showed a lot of empathy in my home. You could be in a very difficult state emotionally, but no one ever asked, how are you? You don't look so good today. So coming into marriage, I was very independent. I learned to make my own decisions. I learned to take care of myself. If there was a problem, I solved it on my own. And while I loved being married, I can look back now and say, did I really need him? No, not really, because I grew up learning to take care of myself.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that one of those results of that was that you didn't know how to be honest with your feelings. Will you tell us that story of that first time you were really honest about what you felt like and just how he reacted? And I mean, I just connected with that so much because I think you don't want to be too needy. You don't want to make them be exhausted by you. Will you tell us that story?
Well, gosh, there were several stories along that line and those themes. But I think if you don't know what you feel, you won't know what you need. Feelings are like a barometer. They're like a little light on your dashboard that says you need oil, your car's running low. And they tell you that something's going on under the hood. Well, feelings are the same way. They tell you that something is happening internally and that you probably need something. But if you have to cut your feelings off, then you cut off your ability to know what you need. So it's hard to have an honest conversation when you've disowned neediness your whole life. And I can remember times where I would begin to feel, when I started to learn to feel, it was very frightening because I kind of felt like neediness was pathetic. And honesty about really telling him where I was at, especially if I wasn't okay, was very hard because in my home, it wasn't okay to not be okay.
So being I remember you telling me how overwhelming I was. And that was hard for her to tell me that my pursuit was overwhelming her. It was literally suffocating her. And for her ability to then begin to tell me how she felt was a radical departure from how we had lived life for the years prior.
I feel like that's another extreme, though, as young adults we fall into is either we feel everything and we feel so much and we make decisions based on what we're feeling or we ignore what we're feeling. So where's that balance? Because I think that's a problem with all the love styles, right, is that acknowledging what you feel.
You know, we have personalities. So Kay and I in our offices, our counseling offices, we use the Myers-Briggs type indicators. So you have introvert and extrovert, thinker, feeler, et cetera, et cetera. And so you have a personality. Some people are more feelings oriented and they operate through their feeling base.
Usually women, right?
No.
Not necessarily.
No.
It depends how you were raised.
Interesting.
No, well, your personality, you could have men who are feelers also. Now, this is personality. This is you're born typically with these traits and characteristics of your personality. And in the Myers-Briggs, you can research that. It gives a great personality rendering as to what your basic type is. These attachment wounds are not about gender. It's not about male or female. Kay was an avoider. Typically, men are stereotyped as being emotionally avoidant. I know a lot of men, they're very emotionally oriented and feeling oriented. So we mustn't make the error of thinking it's a pure gender issue. What I'm responsible to do, Catherine.
You're really bothering me as a pleaser right now.
Am I?
I'm just kidding.
What I'm responsible to do is create a balance in my life. I can become too morbid and morose and stare at pain too much, or I can, over on the other side, I can pretend it doesn't exist. Now, what's interesting is if we become Christians, the Bible says that God makes us into a new creature. The old things have passed away, and behold, new things have come. But that doesn't mean that God erases our history. The Old Testament is a big, thick book of history that the New Testament repairs. And so God is a very historical God, and he doesn't erase our C drive when we come to Christ. What our experiences and memories and our imprints and both the positive and the negative are still with us. He doesn't take that knowledge away or that history away. I have to figure out what are the good parts of my history that are affecting my relationship and what are the challenging or negative parts. One of the things that's very interesting is how many women have been hurt sexually by men, and they've been abused, hurt, mistreated. Well, that has an effect upon them. Even if they're Christians, they walk into marriage and they're automatically going to be leery and have pain, and they're going to have emotional pain. They're just not going to walk into marriage with these open arms. They're going to walk in with reservations and distrust that's going to be naturally there, that a couple has to learn to talk through to get over. I'm not those guys. Or I want to treat you differently, or I'm sorry about those things that happened to you.
Right. And if you're listening and you're kind of thinking, well, maybe I do have some of those things I haven't grappled with, I really encourage you to call Focus on the Family's counseling line. We'll have a link on this episode page. Just go to boundless.org and search for 584. So I want to go through the rest of the attachment styles and then end kind of with what you all did to be that secure connector that you talk about. So the other ones are the
vacillator.
Vacillator and the chaotic.
The chaotic.
So what's vacillator?
The vacillator is someone who comes from a family where there is some connection, but it's inconsistent, and it's usually more based on the mood of the parent than on perhaps the need of the child. So if you are raised in this kind of home, what you feel is like, oh, I want more of that connection. That was great. I want to experience that again. But there's always the waiting for that parent to show up and be available. So there's always abandonment in the home of a vacillator. Most often, usually it can be the parent's home, they're just not available. Or it could be there's a divorce. But the abandonment theme makes the vacillator feel like, well, if I could just make my relationships ideal, then I won't ever have to feel any of that pain.
So they're constantly disappointed, right?
Yes. They're idealists. And they love the dating phase because there's a lot of time and attention. But when you marry and you throw a few kids in there and there's the waiting comes in again, then that's a trigger for the vacillator, and they have an ideal standard to avoid pain, but nobody can keep up with their ideal standard, so they're constantly disappointed.
And then what's the chaotic one?
The chaotic is just as the word implies, from the child's perspective growing up, the infant to the toddler to the child to the adolescent, there's chaos around them. Or another way to phrase that is it's disorganized. So this is the dangerous home. This is the home where the child is endangered, where there are addictions, where there is abuse, where there is neglect. There is a home where there are multiple parents, step-parents, foster situations, stepdads, where there are all of a sudden step-siblings brought into the equation, what I call the forced family. We like to call them blended families. I call them forced families because the kids are shoved together. And sometimes there is abuse from some of those kids to other kids, even sexual abuse. And in this home, there's fright without solutions. The child can't go to anybody for help. The parent is not there to be a parent. The child is going to somebody, and they are simultaneously dependent upon this person to provide shelter and food. But this parent is acting irresponsibly because they are themselves broken. They have their own addictions. And so it's a home where the child tends to end up being, over time, they flip either into a controller mode where they decide, I'm going to take charge of my world so I don't feel that way ever again. And it's a world where compliance is required of other people. Do it my way or else I'm going to be angry at you. And I'll get angry to protest just like the vacillator, but I'm not protesting for ideal connection. I'm protesting for compliance. Or if I'm not a controller, I might continue to stay the victim. And I've tolerated the intolerable my whole life. I don't know how to say no to anybody. And so I will continue to be victimized my whole life.
Something I think I've seen a pattern with my friends is they're attracted to those really strong, controlling guys, though, because I think in dating, it's very attractive at first because they know who they are. They seem like very healthy guys. How do you know as a woman or a man when you're dating somebody? Obviously, everybody has sins. Everybody struggles. How do you know if someone's in a place where they're getting to a healthy spot with these attachment styles and just the way they love, or if they really have a lot of work to do and maybe you shouldn't date them right then?
Well, I think a great, one of the most important qualities you can pick in a spouse besides being a believer is that they're willing to grow. So we encourage people who are dating or thinking of engagement to read How We Love and to see if the person that you're dating will own, oh, yeah, I'm a pleaser, I'm a vacillator. And will they own that? Will they work on it? and if the answer is no, this is just who I am, I don't want to do this stuff, this is a waste of time, then I say run. Because I think you want someone who's willing to own their own injuries and grow. And it's such an important trait that's going to last a lifetime. And the other thing I would say is you never really know someone until you say no. And, you know, dating is a lot of yeses. But until you say no or draw a boundary, you don't really know a person. So I encourage people to use their no muscle in dating and just see what the response is.
That's interesting.
I just wrote down the same thing. I was going to say the same exact thing.
Look at you.
Yeah. What does a terp person do when I say no? Can they tolerate it? A real controller won't be able to tolerate that. You ask in the context of the controller. They won't be able to tolerate
that. That's so funny because one of my friend's policy is that she's going to break up with a guy before she marries him just to see how he takes it.
You know
that's
what?
That's pretty good.
I think, while I think there are elements of immaturity in that, I applaud it because she's seen what will this person do with the word no.
Right.
I would rather see her say, let's take a 3-month hiatus in our relationship and see what the person does with that rather than breaking up with him, et cetera. Another thing I tell females and young women is see what the male does with no with respect to sexual advances and overtures. Mm-hmm. Can they tolerate a no? And the person you want to marry is a person who can tolerate you as a person saying no to them or different. And I'm not talking about sexuality right now. I have a different preference as to what I'd like to do right now. So for a lot of people, this highly controlling person feels like a leader and they feel like a person that takes control. Problem with that is they may take control your whole life and never let you have a voice.
Yeah. Let's kind of end hopeful because this is all like, a lot of stuff to work on for all of us.
It's heavy stuff.
So describe that the final love style, the secure connector, and what hope do all of us messed up single dating people have for healthy marriages?
Well, you have a lot of hope because, you know, we live in an imperfect world. And I think, you know, my adult children are now mid-age and they're really recognizing, well, this is a little harder than I thought it was going to be. So if we come in to marriage too idealistic, then, you know, I mean, any relationship takes some work. But I think when you come into marriage saying, okay, this is going to expose some of my weaknesses and there's going to be areas I need to grow, then I think that's such a positive starting point to realize that, you know, we're going to have some issues and we're going to need to work through them and not be shocked by that. It doesn't mean you married the wrong person. It means that you're normal.
Yeah, it's so hard, though. Working at Focus on the Family, I've been exposed to so much premarital resources. But the things, I think being engaged and actually experiencing it is so different. And I think you always think it's easier than it actually is. I mean, it's also better than I imagined, but just harder.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I want to say to the listeners, that's normal, that, you know, you're different people, and to learn to coordinate and navigate those differences is a part of what the marriage relationship is all about.
Mylan, will you describe that secure connector for us?
I will. But let me say that bliss is reserved for heaven. Marital bliss, relational bliss, a harmonious life that is blissful. That's heaven. We live in a fallen, broken world. And so what attachment research reveals to us is that as soon as we get into relationship, we start to wobble. We all feel like we're kind of exposed. I start to feel feelings of reactivity toward you, which takes us back to that first thing that I mentioned a little while ago. It's about reactivity. A secure person knows how what they're feeling on the inside. If we just think about Jesus for a minute, he could identify what was in his own soul. He was not afraid nor shy to tell people around him what he was thinking and feeling. He could empathize deeply with other people. He was sensitive enough in a crowd to feel the touch of another person. He was aware of others around him. He could tell of their distress because he was aware of how they looked. He could ask for things. There's this fabulous passage in John where he's sitting at a well in the middle of the day and he says to the woman, can I have some water? It could be obvious that he wanted water. He's sitting by a well and watching a woman draw this. But he actually asked for what he needed. He asked the disciples the night before he died to be close to him and pray with him. He wasn't afraid to speak truth to people, even though it was hurtful. He could tolerate people walking away from him and not chase them down when he was speaking truth. He could tolerate separation, therefore. So these are a few of the traits and characteristics of a secure person.
Awesome. Well, folks, I really recommend you read Mylan and Kay's book, How We Love. I started reading it, and I was glued to it. Not that it was a happy, fun thing to read, necessarily.
Not a happy glue.
But it was so good, and it explained so much about myself. Just the first couple of chapters, I was like, wow, this is fascinating. So thank you so much for taking time to share this stuff with us.
Oh, we love being with you. Thank you for inviting us.
It's a delight, Catherine. Thank you so much.
The first day that
All right, folks. Well, as we open up our inbox, we have got the fabulous Joshua Rogers here. Joshua, hey.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. We are excited, I just want to say, for your book that is coming out later this year. You and I were just talking about it, Confessions of a Happily Married Man. So stay tuned, y'all. More info on that to come. But meanwhile, you must answer a question for us. And this is a guy who I think you're going to be able to offer some help to. He says, it's often said that girls are attracted to confidence. I'm wondering if this has affected my attempts at relationships. I don't feel very confident in my abilities because I look at my life and don't see myself as very competent in anything tangible. So I'm thinking maybe that affects how I present myself. How do I make sure I'm presenting myself in an authentic yet confident way?
Well, I really do appreciate your question, and I think it's shared by a lot of people. I can tell you that if it makes you feel any better, there are a lot of guys out there who appear to be confident, and they're not. I think I was probably one of those guys when I was dating. I think he would have said that. You know, he likes to go out on dates. You know, he engages easily with women, but I really wasn't. I felt extremely insecure, and I was just, like, worried about my looks. I was worried about the way I was coming across, and so don't feel bad about that. I think that the first thing is that you were confident enough to ask this question. You were confident enough to say that, hey, I'm not sure that I know how to come across as confident. So, number one, you've got confidence. Number two, in terms of confidence, I've found sometimes that, you know, when you worry about doing something or getting something right, a lot of times you end up doing it more poorly. So, for example, you know, you're on the tightrope, and if you're not thinking about the tightrope, then you can cross at least more easily. Especially if you know there's a net down there. But if you're on there and you're like, I'm on a tightrope, I can't fall, there's not going to be a net down there, I'm going to, you know, when you kind of sort of get caught up in that sort of internal panic, which is so easy for all of us in different ways, then you're more likely to fall off. Now, I think what Lisa and I or anybody can tell you is we all have those places where we become irrationally afraid. And it's different things for different people, and there are not quick fixes for those. There really aren't. You know, you talk about psychiatrists and stuff like that or psychologists, they'll tell you, look, when it comes to things you feel anxious about, just repeatedly do it. Make sure you know you do plenty of public speaking. It'll eventually get easier. Maybe it will, but might not. And that's okay, and I'll tell you why. It's because I'm assuming you're a believer, and if you are, then you're a man's man. You know, Jesus, the Son of Man, he made you. You know, get somebody to check your DNA. You are a man. And there's nothing in particular you have to do to make yourself more manly. There's not something you have to do to supplement that. You are who he says you are. I do want to encourage you to bring people in who, number one, are going to help you see your best, and number two, will help you maybe adjust the rest. So, for example, you might wear dad jeans. You don't even realize it. I actually had a lot of clothes that I thought were very cool when I met my wife, and they are no longer in my closet. And it's just maybe somebody can help with practical stuff. And, you know, you'd said that you're not competent at anything tangible. And with respect to being competent at something tangible, I don't know what that means. But we're all competent at something. And you might be competent, for all I know, at gaming. You might be competent at singing on the worship team at church. I don't know. Please, I know you have something. Don't sit there and say, no, I don't have anything. You do have something. And I want to encourage you to do that. I want to encourage you to join a group of people, a small group at your church that does that. Why? Because that's an area where you have confidence, and it's going to show. So, you know, again, what I'd say is just, brother, go for it. Have people around who love you. That inspires confidence. Do things that you're good at because I know you are. And remember that even though you feel antsy, we all feel this stuff. You are who he says you are, and you are a man's man. That's what I got to say.
All right. Well, awesome advice. I think that will get him started on his way. And I think as a female, I would just reiterate that and say, yeah, I mean, the first step is to be just genuine, to be yourself and to be growing in the things that you're about. You know, don't wake up and say, today I'm going to act confident. Start out with being genuine. And I think that's going to take you a long way. All right, folks. Well, that is it for this week's show. Remember, we want you to go over and find our Facebook event page if, in fact, you can join us for our meetup in New York City and then attending the Times Square event live from New York. So just search Boundless NYC Meetup and you will see it there. Indicate your interest and we will give you all the details. That is it for this week's show. I'm Lisa Anderson for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.